And I think, due to my need to go do other things around the station, we're going to get a double dose of Mr. Shepherd this morning. And we will also hear another episode of Quiet Please. So that's pretty much the lineup. We're going to begin. All right, well, see, when it comes to my Shepherd rebroadcasts, I try not to play the same ones more than once. This one we haven't played since 1999, so that's almost 10 years ago. So what the hey, I say. And now that it is May 6th, this day in history, 1966, May 6th of 1966, the cue function isn't working on the cassette player, so it's not exactly cued, but hey, so be it. It's the story of Golden Boy, the Fig Leaf, and other unveilings. Gene Shepherd here on an extended Mass Backwards. Tony Short, by the way. I know many of you are wondering where Tony is. Well, she was rather ill when she called earlier this evening. So I suspect she's going to try to make it in next week when we're asking for money. Yes, the fund drive starts in a little over 24 hours from now, so start saving your pennies. WBAI, as ever, needs your funding. And we need your services to help answer the phones. Now, I'm assuming they have not even, with 24 hours to go, they have not put out a schedule as of yet. I'm assuming overnight pitching will begin right at the beginning and go all the way through, but I, you know, have no way to confirm that. Unless one of the powers that be gives me a call here, which is incredibly unlikely at 3:37 in the morning. But just bear in mind that these fund drives are relentless once they start, and it starts at 7 o'clock on Wednesday morning. All right. With that said, we turn now to Mr. Shepherd with the Golden Boy's unveiling here on Mass Backwards WBAI. New York. I should point out that we heard Earl the Turtle from Dr. Seuss Presents on the Cadman RCA label. The man who spoke to you, none other than Marvin Miller, who played Mike on The Millionaire Show, as well as the voice of the millionaire, as well as, oh, I don't know, he was all over radio from Whistler days. I think he did the commercials on the Whistler, Marvin Miller. All right. We return you now to the world of Gene Shepherd from 1966.
Oh, peek-a-boo. Oh, peek-a-boo, gang. Hello. Hello, crowd. Yeah, curses. Foiled again. Curses. Foiled again. And before we get tonight's program started, I am going to award a brass figurine with bronze oak leaf palm with a special Friday citation to any one of my listeners who can arise above the mire and the muck and the mud of listenerdom and identify who was it who became famous in American literature by repeating those words over and over and over again. Curses. Foiled again. Curses. Foiled again. Who was that? Stand by, gang. It's time for Funsy. Oh, why do I remember that stuff? Would you please give me a few little guitar notes while I set the mood for Friday? Look at that knee action. Oh, watch the way those ankles move. Look at the subtle way that I cut the light. Watch them move. Oh, wow. It's all a matter of timing. It's a matter of spirit. It's a matter of zest to devour that great, vast pie of life. Just Dickett, all the way. Cheddar, cheddar, a la mode. Cheddar, cheddar. All right, gang, who was it who said curses foiled again? I'll give you a clue. It was not Simon McGree, and it was not Earl Wilson. Bring it up. Curses foiled again. Oh, here's a lovely piece of poetry for a Friday night. If I don't drive around the park, I'm pretty sure to make my mark. If I'm in bed each night by 10, I may get back my looks again. If I abstain from fun and such, I'll probably amount to much. But I shall stay the way I am because I do not give a damn. Who was it who wrote those immortal lines? Keep that music behind me while I see who this... yes, hello? Yes. I guess she just wants to say hello, so bring it up there a little louder again. Yeah. Very good. Cut it there. That's it. Excellent. See, lady, you missed your chance again. You just flubbed the dub, as so many people do when given their chance. It's like the time that I saw an outfielder for 15 straight innings standing out in the outfield waiting for that long fly ball, and when it finally came, he caught it in the teeth. Keep that guitar up there for me, because I have one more poem here. This is the only poem that I know of in all the literature that I've ever run across that is written to a dental hygienist. Not much poetry is written about this facet of life. As hygienist, in your dental chair I sit, without a single care, except when tickled by your hair. I know, baby, that when you grab the drills, I need not fear the pain that kills. You merely make my molars clean with pumice doped with wintergreen. So, baby, I lean back in calm reflection with the close-up views of your complexion and taste the flavor of your thumbs. Well, you massage my flabby gums. Yes. Yes, to me, no woman can be smarter than she who scales away my tartar, and none more fitted for my bride than one who knows me from inside. At least as far as she has gotten, she sees how much of me is rotten. I think this is a beautiful piece of poetry, because it describes a subtle feeling that almost all of us, being part of this automated, fantastic world of non-involvement with other people, that we do feel those little moments of embarrassment. Have you ever had that moment, Al, when this chick who's about to clean your teeth looks in, you know, the girl with that white dress, that virginal white, and she's got that blonde washed look, and she looks down in there, and she reaches up, she takes that drill, and she looks down, she says, how long has it been since you've been here? And there's that sickening feeling, I went somewhere else last time. And she starts moving back and forth. She says, you'd better see the doctor. And you get that look in the eye of she's dealing with some kind of loathsome beast. Something that's got scales growing on it, little claws and fur. Something that has strange exotic aromas arising from it. Like swamp gas at twilight. Well, would you please provide me with a little moonlight and roses, Al? Please, moonlight. Oh, that's magnificent. Bring it up there. Cha-da-cha-da-cha-da. Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Just imagine yourself seated now on a shadowy terrace. And beside you is a girl who stirs you more strangely than an heiress. It is a summer evening at its most superb, and the moonlight reminds you that to love is an active verb. And the stars are twinkling like anything, and a distant orchestra is playing some sentimental old Vienna thing, and your hand clasps hers, which rests there without shrinking. And after a silence fraught with romance, you ask her what she is thinking, and she starts and returns from the moon-washed distances to the shadowy veranda. And says, I was wondering how many bamboo shoots a day it takes to feed a giant baby panda. Or you stand with her on a hilltop and gaze on a winter sunset, and everything is as starkly beautiful as a page from Sigrid Unset, and your arm goes round her waist, and you make an avowal which for masterfully marshaled emotion content might have been a page of Ouida or Thackeray. And after a silence fraught with romance, she says, "Hey, I forgot to order the limes for the daiquiri." Or, in a twilight drawing room, you have just asked the most momentous of questions. And after a silence fraught with romance, she says, "You know, I think this little table would look better where that little table is, and then where that little table would go. Have you got any suggestions, huh?" And that's the way they go around, hitting below our belts. It isn't that nothing is sacred to them. It's just that at the sacred moment, they're always thinking of something else. Who wrote that? Oh, the romantic. You see that woman there? She flubbed the dub, didn't she? And what did she say afterwards? Well, I didn't know. Hey, you know, you want to hear, of course, it's Friday night, and you can sort of unbuckle a little bit and let your, just let it go, you know, just let it fly. I've often heard it said that one of the great values of radio is that the mind is in use, as opposed to that little cabbage that's stuck there between your eyes, that little cabbage of whatever it is, that comes from just sitting there with your mouth agape, staring endlessly at the Beverly Hillbillies. Just staring, staring endlessly. Just think now, at this minute, how many trillions of people are sitting out there in the darkness, right here in America, right now at this moment, just sitting there, watching some total piece of tripe, just sitting there, going, And you blah, 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 pow, pow, pow. The roar of gunshots, the thunder of the posse, first running to the left and then running to the right, and then on comes the commercial, then the posse again, thunder to the right, then to the left, pow, 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 pow. And Chuck Connors sort of looms up from behind a rock and says, "I'll get them bombing shit." Pow, 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 pow. Millions of them at this very minute. Millions of them. Do you realize what we could do if we could get into that network, wherever it is that it's all coming from, and insert about 8 seconds of a very crucial piece of film? Just pew, it goes past that quick. Millions of them sitting there looking at this, afraid to admit that they saw what they saw, and suspecting that they didn't see what they saw, but they imagined that they see what they saw, what they didn't see, and thinking, "What's the matter? Is my mind going totally rotten? Am I the rotten one? And here I'm surrounded by kids and women and children and people who think beautiful thoughts. And over the corner sits Granny by the ferns. And her old mind says, 'Well, I haven't thought something like that in years. I better not let the kids know.'" Back and forth she rocks with her girdle creaking. Yes, just think what we could do. It's radio. It's television. It's the world of mass communications. And you're sitting out there, rocking back and forth, waiting for whatever it is to come out, whatever fantastic revelations that are lurking behind the cacti to emerge. And it's Friday. Ooh, a dangerous night. I wonder how many guys make fatal mistakes on a Friday night. And in fact, you know, that's an interesting thought right now. Just to contemplate at this minute. It's Friday night, you know. That's different from, say, Wednesday or Tuesday. Think of this very instant. right now, this instant. How many people are about to make a mistake that will never be undone? No, I mean, really. Because, you know, the world is filled with millions and millions, probably billions of people who sit quietly around the dinner table, who sit calmly, solemnly watching the late, late movies, who have lurking way back in the darkness of their memory the specter of that moment. That moment when they dealt themselves that bad card. That bad, and they dealt it to themselves. And in many cases, they even palmed it. Which is worse. Had they allowed the cards to be just dealt fairly and squarely, they might have gotten something else. But they dealt this thing to themselves and probably even, in so many instances, stuck it up their sleeve. And now they sit out there. Would you please give me a little, that's it, just a little music there, just anything, just to calm them down out there. Oh, yes. Oh, we are all sitting here rocking in the cradle of the deep. Yes, sitting here in this fantastic rented rowboat that we are all sharing, each and every one of us. This big old fat rowboat made out of lead, rocking away on this Sargasso Sea of existence. This momentary snippet out of that great cosmos, that swirling eternity of whatever it is that we call time. Yes, sirree. And the bailing cans are ready to be used. The bilge pumps are squirting all over the place. Cha-cha, 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 rick-a-tink-a-tink-a-tink-a, rasputas, rat-cha-cha-cha-cha-cha-cha-cha-cha-cha, rat-cha-cha-cha-cha-cha-cha-cha-cha-cha,
moonlight and roses. Oh, reminding me of you, Rasputas.
Talking about rented rowboats doomed to eternity. This is WOR, AM and FM, New York. Hit the little money button, will you please, Alfred?
There's only one champagne of bottle beer. Sparkling, flavorful, distinctive. Miller High Life. Brewed from a century-old recipe, Miller High Life has a rich heritage and tradition.
Isn't it awful? I'll sit here and
clear taste.
Listen to a beer commercial and drink a tab.
Unchanging. Oh, available on tap, in cans, and in familiar crystal clear bottles. Miller High Life is always sparkling, flavorful, distinctive. Enjoy Miller High Life yourself.
Miller High Life, the champagne of bottled beer.
Yes, Miller High Life, the champagne of bottled beer.
A champagne with bottled beer. Oh, you know, some night remind me to tell you the story about the yearning in the press box. You know that all these guys that are advertising beer all the time, these ball announcers, these baseball announcers, are not allowed to drink beer in the press box, you know that. Didn't you know that? Oh, sure. Oh, that's a fact. And so they keep looking at the monitor, and they keep seeing these giant bottles of beer all the time. And it's about in the seventh inning, and it's getting awful hot up there, and the sun is beating down. And that's a story. I'll have to tell you about that sometime. A little incident I have to know about. And while we're on the subject of stories, we have with us Fleischman Honda here tonight. And as you probably know, a couple of nights ago, I talked a little bit about the fact that I'm breaking in my new Honda Super Hawk, which I picked up at Fleischman's out on Queens Boulevard. a couple of weeks back, and I'll tell you, you know, I've noticed more and more as you go along over here in Vanderbilt, all these areas around the Pan Am building, long lines of motorcycles owned by businessmen who use these things to come here to Manhattan from work. This is getting to be the biggest thing around, and for good reason. Have you ever tried to get across town any time of the day these days? Well, if you're thinking of a motorcycle, you better think real fast of Fleischmann. Fleischmann Honda, they have a superb service department. In fact, they have a service department that's so famous among motorcycle people that guys bring their motorcycles from all around the area to Fleischmann's to get them fixed up. Now, Fleischmann, of course, sells Honda, and they have the entire line, ranging all the way from the little pop-ups, you know, the little cutie pie types for the chicks with the vinyl skirts, all the way up to the kind that go, wah! That's another kind of motorcycle. Oh, yeah, the kind with teeth. And they have them all. This is Fleischmann Honda, and they're out on Long Beach Boulevard, West Islip on Sunrise Highway, Bayshore, Sunrise Highway, and the place I always go, which is out on Queens Boulevard in Woodside, just 1 mile west of that new Macy's out there. And when you get out there, you ask for old Al, and he'll point out the model that I'm driving. You know, of course, I have a motorcycle of the type that you don't drive, it drives you. That's that's another kind of machine. Speaking of machines, we also have with us Rover tonight. And, well, wouldn't you just love to be on hand just once in your life to have the right franchise at the right time in history? Well, I'll tell you, I'm serious when I say that the Rover people, the people who import the Rover, are on the right corner at this time in history with all this flap about motor safety and one thing and another. This is an automobile that is recognized not only to be one of the most safe automobiles ever built, but one of the most advanced engineering jobs in the entire world of automotive design. And incidentally, it is considered in places where they are knowledgeable about cars. This car is considered to be in the same class as such machines as the Rolls-Royce. This is the Rover 2000 TC. And not too long ago, I believe it was the Vancouver Assembly, which is like their Congress up there, they passed a resolution about safety, and they said it's almost impossible to buy a safe car anywhere in the world. And they're talking about European cars, American cars, with the exception of the Rover 2000, which they named, and the Mercedes 220. So this Rover is a fine car, and if you would like to get pictures of it, we'd be delighted to send them along to you. Just send your name and address to me. My name is Spot. And we'll send you all those pictures of the Rover there. And I think you'll enjoy it. Hit the little button. Now, this is one of them sexy type commercials here. They're selling everything with sex these days, except sex. Turn me loose on Trade World. Let me love. Let me love on Trade World. Let me run through the world. With the pop of a pearl. I'll make spring.
Go ahead. I'm crazy.
Go ahead, what?
Let it happen.
Let what happen?
And we'll live.
Let what happen?
By Cody.
Oh, isn't she cute?
And now, Ombre Blue Spray Mist is here.
Ombre Blue Spray Mist.
And it's wonderful for men, too. Ombre Blue, let it happen. Have you noticed how many things are being sold with absolute outright sexual connotations these days? Outright. Everything from detergents to, well, almost anything. Just you just name it. you know, and they're really laying it out. And the funny part of it is that I suspect that the little old ladies who are sitting out there who get very angry when they see that kind of stuff in plays don't even recognize it in ads. Just don't recognize. They don't expect to see it in ads. And so when they do see it, they say, "Oh no, that isn't what they mean." When that chick says, "Let it happen. Entrez-vous." What do they think she means? What's she talking about? Let it happen. Go to the A&P? Or, what, you know? Oh, yes, sir. That's my baby. That's... Oh, speaking of the changing times of which we are all part. No doubt about it. We're all part of it, and it's swinging left, right, and sideways. Oh, one of my friends counted this. He said that he counted 15 commercials in less than 20 minutes on television, you know, going from channel to channel the other night. And he says out of the 15, 7 of them used the word swinger. And that's this year's word. Last year's was tiger. You remember everything was tiger? Now it's all dead. Poor old tiger. Those poor guys that got tigers in their tanks are, boy, really out of it, you know. And now I suppose you have to have a swinger in your tank. I've known many swingers who have wound up in the tank, but that's another story. You know, speaking of the changing, hey, I don't know whether I should do this or not, because, of course, we got the Limelight Show tomorrow night. Should I tell you the story tonight of the giant fire in the chandelier? Or the epic of the underground sports event? A. The Alfresco Olympics? Or shall I save that for tomorrow night when I'm at the Limelight? For those of you who wonder about the Limelight, we are at the Limelight every night from, or rather every Saturday night from 10:30 until midnight. We will be there tomorrow night, the same. We're liable to come on the air a little later tomorrow night, so stick around. Yeah, I think there's a special show that is scheduled just before us. So if you tune in and somebody's giving a speech, or if you tune in and somebody's passing the hat around or something, just hang on, because we will arrive very shortly from the Limelight with the sound of decadence and all that stuff, and people eating hamburgers and yelling and hollering and pinching each other. And, you know, it's kind of an orgiastic thing. And that we're there until midnight. And if you are planning to make the scene, planning to be down there early before the show, okay? We're planning something. It involves a Greek chorus. Speaking of Greek chorus, Allie, ready in there now? I've got a great story here. Should I or should I not? That's all right. It'll be the salute to English music if I tell that story. Should I or should I not tell the epic of the fire in the chandeliers? Or should I save that for tomorrow? Oh, no. It's the kind of story that's going to require a particularly broad-minded crowd. And Friday night may be pretty racy, but it isn't like Saturday night. Now, it has nothing to do with the questionable material, but it's the kind of thing where you got to allow your mind to run. Just run, you know. Do you remember a record? There was a great record one time called Let Me Run Barefoot Through Your Mind, Baby. You ever hear that one? Yeah. You don't know who did that, huh? That was a great record. He was also the same guy that turned out a record called Dinner Music for Hungry Cannibals. Yeah. Same guy. All right. Speaking of great, I want you to now quietly sit there for a minute. I want you to allow this to pass through your mind. Just see it. I want you to see England in your mind. You got it there? England? You can see Big Ben standing there. The mother of us all, Parliament, over there. And you can see the Thames lying gray and steely under those ancient skies. And you can see Winnie with his fingers in the bee. Ah, we all fight them from the beaches. Ah, you see that, okay? And you can see the old bridge of London itself. And the tower, oh, wow. And you can see Soho. You see it over there? Chelsea. The whole scene. I'm talking about ancient London. You got it? Got that picture? This is not the London of James Bond. Oh, no. This is not the London of the Beatles. This is not the London of the mods at Carnaby Street. This is the London of Richard III. This is the London, the England, of the line of the Tudors. You see them? The Plantagenets. You see them marching across the horizon there? Their chainmail clanking. It is ancient London. That London, that England, that little bit of sacred green soil. Ah, you see it? Yes. We bring you a special report from London.
The staid City Corporation of London said today permission has been granted to D. Figleaf, one of London's most glamorous statues. Known as the Golden Boy, a gilded statue of a naked boy has stood on Giltspur Street since 1792. Originally, he stood on the outside wall of a pub called The Fortune of War. The pub was demolished about 50 years ago to make way for a new building now occupied by the New Zealand Refrigerator Company. The Golden Boy was erected to mark the spot where the Great Fire of London flickered out in 1666. During the Great Fire, two-thirds of London's houses were destroyed, along with 100 churches. For 134 years, the Golden Boy stood on his wall perch in all his boyish nudity. When in 1926, a gentleman, his name, now veiled by time and his outlook then on such things starched with Victorian prudery, passed by the naked statue. Some City of London wenches were making, ribald remarks about the boy, said the old man. He was furious. He stormed into his office and said the boy should be covered. That is, certain parts of the boy should be covered. And he was. There was placed in a strategic point a fig leaf. Ever since then, he has been discreetly covered. As this is the 300th anniversary of the Great Fire, I thought something should be done, said the Director of Parks and Monuments of the Corporation of the City of London. I thought something should be done to restore the Golden Boy to his natural state. And after much deliberation, the City Corporation decided to issue the D. Fig Leafing Order. Oh, I am very pleased, said the managing director. People certainly are more broad-minded these days. He said that the fig leaf was attached by a stout nail, and years of regilding have anchored the fig leaf firmly. Oh, we'll have it off in time for the 300th anniversary of the Great Fire. That's September 2nd. You know, that presents a fantastic picture. Just think of the picture now. Reset that, would you please, Al? Can't you see the picture now? All the dignitaries have gathered. Now, this is a historic statue. It's the Golden Boy, see? And all the dignitaries in their high silk hats and the guys with the television cameras are there. And thousands of people from the City of London have assembled. The Queen is there on her horse, dressed in the uniform of a Colonel of the Guards. And you can see all the panoply of the ancient City of London spread out before us now. And there in the corner is the Golden Boy. And standing in front of the Golden Boy are two city officials and a little short man wearing overalls. And he has a chisel. And with him are two other gentlemen, one of them holding a can of paint, the other one holding a little sandpaper. And then the mayor of the City of London mounts the podium and addresses that tremendous audience of Englishmen everywhere on the British Broadcasting Corporation's third program, their television series relating to the monuments and the spires of the City of London. And he says, on this historic day, September 2nd, we are marking the 300th anniversary of the Fire of London. And here, on this very spot, where we stand here today to do great honor to the past and Englishmen everywhere who have lived and died like true Englishmen. We stand on this spot where was erected this superb example of 17th century art to mark the point where the last ember, the last flicker of flame of the disastrous fire of London flickered out. And it was here that modern London was born. And now, while the cameras are whirring everywhere, and as the Queen, and God bless her, has seen fit to come and pay our honored presence here this morning, as we all sit assembled as Englishmen,
we must say the time is now to allow the past to flow unimpeded into the future. Gentlemen, if you please. And the little man in the overalls takes his chisel. The fig leaf is loosened, the camera's dolly in. Off comes the fig leaf, and once again, England stands naked and unashamed, facing the world in a close-up. What a scene. Oh, wow. Oh, you know, that reminds me, I'll tell you, that reminds me of the time. Have you ever been at a statue unveiling? I always see these on films. But I happen to have been at a statue unveiling that I will never forget. It happened in the city of Cincinnati. Now, Cincinnati is a pretty, you know, pretty square city, and yet it's a pretty hip city on the other hand. It's kind of a European city, you know? And the sun shines down on it, and that great river flows out on one side and on the other. And I was working in radio at the time. I was a mere stripling. Yes, an apple-cheeked lad with a glowing blue eye. Who was on hand with my microphone to interview the city fathers and the official people. You know the whole scene, Al Downer with the engineer hiding in the privet hedges with his little portable Collins preamp. And we've got the whole thing. The line has been set in since 3 or 4 days ago, and we've tested it out. And now it's the big remote from where they are going to dedicate this new statue. And the statue had been talked about for about a year and a half before in the newspapers. It had been commissioned. And it was to honor one of the great founding fathers of the city of Cincinnati. Well, not really the great founding father per se. It was to honor his spirit. They kept saying that, his spirit. And already there was a little suspicion around town when they said, this is not a literal translation of the man himself, but it honors his spirit. And this great Eastern European sculptor had worked on this thing. It cost $34,000 to put up. That whole business. And one afternoon it appeared, and the guys came out of the truck and all that, and they had this big white canvas. Well, it's very spectacular. You know, there's something very exciting about seeing a statue standing in the sun covered with that white billowing sheet of nylon. You know, it just sort of floats, and then little stars and stripes all over it, and a little ribbon to cut. It's very exciting. You know, it's like an opening night, a first night. And, you know, and just like many other first nights, there's a moment of indecision. And there can also be bad reviews. And there can also be, you know, a smash hit. Who knows? But there it is. It's standing there in the sun. And we've been setting this thing up. Me and my engineer had been down all morning testing. And a couple of guys had come from the city and set up a podium and a dais. And they put the bunting out and the whole scene that they were talking about. And the line of march will be this way. The American Legion will come around here. And the honor guard will stand over there, and they'll blow the bugles. And the Marine guys over here will shoot the cannons off. And the Ladies' Aid Society from Withrow High School, they're going to march past with their knitting needles held at port. And they go this way, you know, in the whole scene. So we're planning, and we'll be over here and make sure that we have the mic hung so that we can catch the speeches and the music and the whole jazz. Well, the ceremony started out magnificently, although there was a little suspicion that things perhaps were not going entirely right, because a couple of guys showed up, and they had been spending a good long afternoon. You know how, I don't know whether you've ever seen a politician after he's had a long business luncheon. I mean, a long business luncheon, and he arrives, and he's just oozing martinis. And two or three of these old ward healers climbed up on the dais, and they began to look down at the crowd. And it was just terrible. All of a sudden, it looked like a cartoon. You know the cartoon with the fat politician with the dollar bills coming out of his vest? You know, that kind of guy. And the little guy standing down on the ground, it says John Q. And somebody standing on his neck. And the politician's got a big bag with the dollar sign marked on it. It says taxes, you know, that kind of scene. Well, it began to have that whole essence around it from the very beginning. The politicians were paying homage to another politician was what really, in essence, that it boiled down to. And so we're all standing out there with our microphone, and finally the mayor arrives in his big car, a big black caddy with the cops ahead with the red lights and the whole business. The ladies' aide march past with their knitting needles held at port. The band played, the Marines fired the guns, and the mayor is up and he says, "Now we cut the ribbon," and he goes, "Kunk," and it didn't come down. He cut the ribbon and the thing was hung up. And I'm saying into the microphone, the mayor has just cut the ribbon that is about to unveil the statue to the Right Honorable Charles Watanabe, the spirit of Mr. Watanabe, who built the magnificent Queen City of the West, Cincinnati. Uh-oh. Seems to be a little trouble there. One moment you could hear the crowd. Wah, 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 wah. You know, they're terrible. It's just like, you know, the orchestra finishes and somebody tries to pull the curtain up with the Broadhurst and the curtain won't go up. Well, there's a little nervousness. People sit like that. Well, then a little guy comes up there with a pair of overalls and he starts to pull the bottom of the thing. You know, he's like pulling the sheet. Nothing's happening. And the mayor's walking over there and talking to him. And a couple of other guys are pulling the sheet. It's stuck up there, and you can see that it's stuck on something. There's something up there at the top. It looks like either a flag or a pennant or a spear or a torch that's being held aloft or something like that. You pull like this, pull like that. And finally, it comes down. It went, and the crowd stood there for a long, still second. And I have never been, as far as I know, at this point. Of course, I got a long way to go. I have never yet seen a more total disaster than that statue. What a turkey. I mean, even the little old ladies could recognize a bad piece of junk when they saw it. And it was a bad piece of $30,000 junk. And there it was with the big white sheet, the mayor standing there with the scissors in his hand. What a turkey. And of course, there were two or three guys from the Arts Commission there with their ribbons across their chest. They were the official guys. They're standing looking proudly on it. You know, ha, 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 yes, we designed this. You know, very good. And the crowd just sort of stood there for a long moment. You could hear banjos banging against you. You could hear a couple of trombones hitting together and little old ladies' knitting needles clattering. And then there was a little smattering of, hey, this kind of applause, you know. And the mayor turns and he smiles. And I knew I was in the presence of a political fiasco. That more than one guy's head would roll over this. And sure enough, the first one that rolled was the tin head of that statue. It stood there on its pedestal for about 4.5 weeks before the city finally says, well, we made a boo-boo. Let's throw it in the junk. Let's get rid of it. And there were a couple of little editorials about the $30,000 turkey and a couple of more little snide remarks in the press. And one quiet afternoon, this giant 45-foot statue was quietly loaded on a truck and taken away. And right now, it is in an attic somewhere in the city of Cincinnati, just lying there with dust. And I could see the picture myself. I could see the artist, you know. The deadline's coming up. And he's been kidding them for about a year and a half, you know, about how good he's working on this thing. And now, all of a sudden, the deadline is here. It's going to be next Wednesday. They want this big piece of solder that they ordered for $30,000, you know, this big chunk of welding and all that stuff. So he says, oh, what am I going to do? Oh, my God, what am I going to do? Oh, I've just got to do it, and I can't give up. I've already spent the $20,000. Oh, my God. And he runs around, and he calls up four of his friends, and they nail this thing together in about 45 minutes and put it on a flat car, and that's it. What a moment. Hey, you know, speaking of that, I'm going to award you a brass fig leaf with bronze oak leaf palm if you can tell me what was one of the greatest artistic fiascos in the 20th century in connection with a very wealthy family who built a tremendous building. And then they went out, and it's a big wealthy family, you know, it's a big capitalistic family, and they built this giant building in a major city of the United States, which, for want of a better name, we'll call Gotham. And they go out. Oh, no, that's not its real name. That's just a non-diploma. I just invented that name to preserve the guilty. And so they went out, and they hired this famous muralist. Now, you know what is it, a muralist? It's this guy that paints stuff all over the walls, you know, big stuff. They go out, and they hire this muralist, see, to come and paint this tremendous, this fantastic mural, you see, that's going to march all around the lobby of their giant new building, which they are about to dedicate to the public weal. And he works about a year and a half on it in secret. He won't let anybody see it. You know, he keeps putting rags over it, and he keeps coming in at 3 a.m. and painting it and the whole thing. And the big day arrives, and the famous men are on the hand. The mayor is there. The bands are playing. They unveil the mural. It flutters down and is a gigantic anti-capitalistic blast. The mural shows these rich guys oppressing the masses. And unmistakably, you could see the faces of the very guys who bought the painting. You know, one of these big heroic ones? And here they are tromping on the peasants and the workers are going, ah! You know, and you could see those guys laying there. You know how these giant, tremendous, heroic murals. And they all stood there for a long minute with their jaws hanging slack. And the man who put up the Delphoids and said, it's very nice. It's very nice, because after all, he's talking about a great artist, you know, famous artist. It's very good, don't you think so, Charles? It's excellent. It's, yes, I like that fish over there on the side there. That's look at the way the sun comes down. It's beautiful. All those peasant faces crying. That's very good. And here they're looking at 4,000-foot high figures of capitalism stomping on the poor little screaming peasants. It marched across the wall endlessly on and on. All it needed was a group of peasants singing the Internationale. Who was that? That's a true story. Well, needless to say that large sections of that mural have been replaced by candy stands, have been replaced by places where they sell Aero shirts, a few other little things discreetly placed, you know, little fountains and chandeliers and stuff. And now you see a lot of fishers and you see a few people holding flags, but other than that, the meat of the article is neatly excised. Oh, yes. Oh, it's tomorrow night at the Limelight, friends. Fellow. I don't know what, you know, whatever we are. You know. Okay?
And we will have another Gene Shepherd program later on at the usual time at around 5:15. We also found another Lester Smith moment that we will share with you then. The newscaster who often preceded and followed Shepherd, who passed away at the age of 90 earlier or sometime in the middle of April. This is WBAI New York, Mass Backwards. I'm getting a double dose of Mr. Shepherd this morning because, it's busy times here the day before the fun drive, WBAI. Oh, doesn't it seem like we just finished one? Well, it always seems like that, but we have high hopes here at the radio station that a turnabout is imminent.